Hello there. I'm Teresa Matsura, and you're listening to Uncanny Japan. And we're celebrating our 100th episode by doing three shows of spooky tales sent in from patrons, listeners, and a couple from me. On the last Uncanny Japan, episode 100, I shared some stories about ghost-ridden houses, specifically Kate's experience in her new home, built on some very old and very haunted land. I also talked a little about some creepy things that happened to my son Julian and me in our new house when he was little. These were spirits, but not necessarily the ill-intentioned kind. Today's theme, however, is when the ghostie gets you, or tries to get you. I'll read a personal account sent in from Heather, which gave me actual goosebumps. Then tell you one of the most unsettling experiences I've ever had. Top three, definitely. And because I don't want to wrap up the show on a dark, depressing vibe, I'll end with a couple more lighthearted stories from listeners. They're on the sweeter side, but very strange nonetheless. And then, in the next episode, the third in our trilogy, it will be The Strange Outdoors, and a few others that fit nicely in that category. So keep listening. Would you like to explore the stranger, more obscure corners of Japanese culture? Dig a little deeper into superstitions, curious customs, and all those mysterious creatures that inhabit the land? If so, then this is the podcast for you. Uncanny Japan is where I, author Teresa Matsura, share all the fascinating tidbits I unearth while doing research for my writing. From the bizarre to the ghastly, and everything in between. I hope you enjoy the show. Hey, hey, are you ready for some spooky tales? It sounds like we're going to be serenaded by some frogs tonight. First, I wanted to share with you a story from Heather. A tiny bit of background. She's taught all over, and she's taught in Japan 3 times, in Nara, Tokyo, and Shizuoka, where I am. But her eerie experience didn't happen here. It happened in Nara. And it goes something like this. My story takes place in Nara in 2010. I was in a typical teaching situation in that I was hired by a Canadian married couple who had just acquired a conversation school. So many of the perks and amenities of being hired by a large eikaiwa were missing. I needed to find my own housing in a fairly rural location. So when I came across a large house owned by a Canadian who rented it to foreigners, I just had to take it. Among the many charms and quirks of the house were also a few unusual things, none of which were evident upon my initial visit to the house. There were a lot of items left behind by previous inhabitants at different points in the course of the house being offered as a rental. This gave the house a sense of confused time. There were clothes, magazines, and other artifacts from as long ago as the 80s, and as recently as the tenant before me, by my estimate. The house carried noises from the neighbors on either side of it, as each house was connected. I once thought someone was coming tearing down the stairs toward me in the middle of the night, only to discover that my neighbor never removed his work boots, and he stomped around in his own house. On the other side of me, a cat meowed itself into hoarseness before seeming to have become mute. In this setting, I also began to feel a sense of unease about the house. The creepiest feeling room was the one I chose to sleep in, as it was the only room with internet access. I figured if anything weird happened, I could at least make a call to someone about it. Although there were a few noises that came from upstairs at night that seemed pretty unexplainable, by far the strangest thing wasn't what the house did while I was there, but how I began to behave during my time there. To start, I began to forget to eat. I don't know how else to explain it. I had to travel a few train stops away to get groceries, which was sometimes inconvenient, but my lack of interest went beyond the occasional neglect to pick up eggs or rice on my days off. Eating became something I did out of panic after long hours of skipping meals or forgetting dinner. I lost 35 pounds in a very short amount of time, causing my bosses to express concern. I didn't know how to explain it, and I did my best to remember, but it wasn't consistent. I was constantly anxious in the house. In part, this must have been due to my extreme isolation. As I ran the school without coworkers and rarely spoke to anyone in person beyond my students and the school manager. However, it made me feel crazy. I was constantly feeling out of control and nervous in general. Then there were my sleep disturbances. I suffered from insomnia for the first month or so, cramming myself into a love seat in the living room and cycling through Ghibli movies all night. Many times I saw the sun rise before I could sleep at all. Once I finally settled enough to sleep in a room, I couldn't bring myself to sleep upstairs at all and chose the bedroom adjacent to the living room. At first I slept on a futon, on a platform bed frame. Once summer came, I often kept the sliding glass door in the room open and slept on the futon on the floor. Then I stopped using the futon and slept on just the floor, on top of a blanket. I wasn't uncomfortable or experiencing any sort of back pain, so I can't explain why I stopped sleeping on any sort of bed. By the time I left Nara, I was very thin, sleeping on a blanket on the floor without a pillow by choice. When the caretaker of the house came to do an inspection walkthrough with me before I moved out, he said about the room I had been staying in. Boy, this room is really creepy, isn't it? I asked him to tell me what had happened there, both excited and terrified that I wasn't alone and feeling something was absolutely wrong about the room. But he wouldn't tell me what he knew, and wouldn't look me in the eye as he refused. If the situation could be plausibly explained as a mental health crisis, I believe it would have taken some time to recover or bounce back to a sense of normalcy. Nevertheless, my appetite was restored almost immediately upon vacating the house. I was able to sleep again in a bed with pillows. I gained weight. I felt like myself again within weeks. I've learned a lot about Japanese folklore since that experience in Nara, but I'm never one to assume I have enough knowledge to set a definite label on what happened to me in that house. All I know is that I have never experienced anything like it, before or since. The end. This has all the makings of a horror movie, don't you think? I'm so glad Heather was able to move out and feel better, shed whatever it was that was draining her. But don't you have dozens of questions about the house or the land? Like, what happened there? When? This is total speculation, but if something did awful happen there, did the people who rented it out genuinely not know? I mean, they're foreigners too, and maybe they got a good deal on the place without having heard the gory details. In my horror story imagination, I can see a Japanese landlord knowing they'd never be able to rent the place or sell it to a Japanese family because of whatever history it has, and thinking perhaps foreigners don't believe in such things or aren't susceptible to them, and making the deal. Also, I would love to talk to people who have lived there before and since, because I bet they've had some weird stuff happen as well. I'd love to get together with them and Heather over tea and talk. Okay, for the next story, I'm going to tell you about one of the worst things that has ever happened to me. Something I don't like to revisit, but it's freaky and it fits very much in today's theme. and it happened in 2001. After the incident, while I was at Clarion in 2015, I wrote a short essay about what happened and was later encouraged by my wonderful instructor that week, Andy Duncan, to submit it to 14 Times, which I did, and it was accepted and soon published. So instead of me wading through this whole experience, I'm going to read the essay with a few tweaks, and then I'll also talk about the parts that I've never said out loud before. So let's see if we can do this. I called this piece The Visitor, and it all happened before Julian's head-on-the-desk experience that I talked about in episode 100. So he was younger, kindergarten age at the time, and we had just moved into our new house. Here we go. The Visitor. A month after we moved into our new house, my husband's company transferred him halfway across the country. I'm an American expat living in Japan. That's how things are done here. His boss insisted he relocate for the length of the current project, returning home one weekend a month. The idea being that because it was such a short time, there was no reason to spend money to move the entire family. Plus, I was told, since our five-year-old was in kindergarten, it would be too traumatic for him to change schools mid-year. It was decided Julian and I stay put in our newly built home while my husband moved way up north for this new assignment. The situation before he left was that we all slept in the same room. In Japan, families of three often sleep on futons in what is called kawanoji, or the character for river. The Japanese kanji for river from left to right is a long stroke top to bottom, a small one in the middle, and another long one. A family sleeping all lined up would look like the character for river, kawa. Our layout was a little different, though. It went my husband first, me in the middle, then Julian. Now we're in the new house, Daddy's away, and Julie and I have our own little before-bed routine. Something like brush teeth, pro-wrestle on the futons, read a storybook, sleep. Everything's fine. It must have been around the second month of us being alone, though, that I developed this overwhelming feeling of dread. Something really bad was going to happen. I've never had this feeling this intense and ongoing before, and it was terrifying. What started as vague anxiety grew into full-blown panic. Days went by, weeks, and I couldn't shake the constant something terrible is about to happen gut feeling. Somehow along the way, I became convinced that the bad thing was going to happen to Julian. I remember on more than one occasion after he was picked up by the kindergarten bus, I grabbed my keys and followed in my car, convinced the bus was going to get into an accident. Then when it didn't, I'd stop and I'd watch through the fence of the kindergarten and wait until everyone was inside and safe. Creepy, I know, but I felt that if I was nearby, I could stop whatever it was that was going to happen. Mitigate it, maybe. The escalating bad feeling continued until around 5 months of my husband being gone, when we learned the contract was going to take a lot longer than expected, so no idea when he'd be living with us again. I started having nightmares. But through it all, Julian was the one big light in my life. When we were hanging out, running around in various parks, dinner for two, or watching the then brand new Pokemon anime, whatever it was, when he was nearby, everything usually felt okay. Then one night we went to bed after our usual routine, except this time I had a lucid dream, which wasn't new to me, but it had been a while and this one was different in its violence. I thought it was really happening at first. Someone had broken in and was roughly shaking me awake. There was a shadowy, cold man leaning over me. I tried to get up, but he kept using the heels of his hands on my shoulders to knock me back down. I'd scramble and try to get back up, and he'd knock me down again. The final time, though, he sat back and allowed me, my dream self, to sit up. And he smiled, one of those you-know-you're-in-trouble smiles. I was very aware of Julian sleeping beside me. Probably because for months now I was hyper-alerted to something bad happening to him. I wanted to check to see if he was okay, but at that moment this dark man was totally focused on me. Somehow I knew if I looked over, then that's where this man, creature, thing's attention would go. And that wouldn't be good. So I froze. That's when he reached his arm out and pointed at me. Still smiling, he leaned in close until his finger pressed into my chest. I couldn't move. He kept pushing and I could feel his finger burning, like sinking into my skin and then bone. I remembered how shocked I was at the pain. I wanted to scream, but I couldn't. My next memory is waking up the next morning. Julian was sleeping beside me, and he looked okay. I could still feel the lingering pain in my chest and even my shoulders. But it was morning. The dream monster was gone, so, okay, it was just a lucid nightmare then. I woke Julian, and we went downstairs and made breakfast before the kindergarten bus showed up. There was no need for me to mention anything about what happened the night before, especially to him. So it was just a regular breakfast, us sitting across from each other eating rice and miso soup, probably grilled salmon or something. And that's when Julian looked around and asked where Daddy was. Could they play together when he got back from school? I said, no, sorry, Daddy is still out of town, and he's not going to be back until the end of the month. Julian looked at me funny, like he knew I was teasing him. He said, no. He saw Daddy in the bedroom last night. That's when he told me he had woken up in the middle of the night and saw Daddy sitting on the futon beside me, staring down at me. Now that's creepy enough, but it gets worse. Not long after that, I went to the hospital because that burning sensation where he touched me wouldn't go away. I felt around and I found a lump in my breast. I was scared, but part of me didn't think it could actually be cancer because it was golf ball sized and just appeared so suddenly, and I was only 33 years old. I had already planned a trip back to the States so Julian could have his first real Halloween, so I decided to go to the doctor there, one I was familiar with. It was only a few weeks away. We flew back a week or so after 9/11 happened, in a plane full of white-knuckling passengers who all cheered when we landed. I saw the family doctor the day after I got back, and he referred me to a bigger hospital. Very long story that involved a negative biopsy that was doubted by an incredible surgeon who called for a more intrusive biopsy, short, and it was breast cancer, stage 3, aggressive, and very weird on several counts I learned from my amazing oncologist later. He said it didn't look like normal breast cancer or to have started in the breast. They were sure it had metastasized from somewhere else. There were so many tests, but nothing else was found. As I'm sure every one of you understands, my reaction to the diagnosis was overwhelming relief, actually. At least it's me. I can handle me being sick. If it had been my kid, I don't know what I would have done. Anyway, I decided to stay in the States for treatment. Almost a year for surgery and 2 rounds of chemo. The good news is Julian got to go to an American kindergarten, make friends, experience American life, doing things that aren't done in Japan, like making a lemonade stand or having a blowout birthday party where you get to invite all your friends over and they bring presents. He also became fluent in English in weeks and spent a lot of time with his American grandma and grandpa. I'm an only child and he's an only child, so their only grandson. The other good news is that the feeling of dread completely disappeared after surgery. And the thing I don't like to talk about even more than that story, but is kind of important just to show how tumultuous everything was, is that I had a miscarriage during this time span as well, early on before we made the trip to the States. It took years to have Julian, so this was kind of a miracle baby, as I wasn't getting fertility treatments at the time. But the story of the miscarriage is another dramatic event altogether. Being rushed to the one hospital you never want to go to because it's so old and so gross, and every time you've ever gone, something horrible has happened. But that's more of a medical body horror story, not a ghostly one. So I'll leave that for another day, when I have the strength. So that's my weird experience. Okay, let's change up the mood. Let me share you a story by Nemuri Mori. I think it's sweet, and it goes like this. My story isn't scary, but I think uncanny is a good fit. I was fortunate enough to visit Japan once so far with my husband. I found a great little guest house in Kyoto in an area that felt more like a real and not just touristy neighborhood. And the room was much bigger than the standard hotel room, with a kitchenette and a washing machine in the room. One night, I took my engagement ring off and placed it on the table in our room before washing my hair. My husband had gone to bed while I was showering, and I didn't want to wake him by turning on the light. So I left the ring where it was to be put on the next morning. In the morning, however, I couldn't find my engagement ring. I told my husband, and we carefully went through everything on the table, cleared off the table, checked the floor. I checked my suitcase in case I had packed it away and forgotten. We went through my clothes, but no luck. We were very upset, but there was nothing to be done about it. A few days later, we were in the room, and my husband asked where I'd found my engagement ring. I asked him what he meant, and he just pointed at the table, and there it was, right where I had remembered leaving it. The guest house didn't offer housekeeping during the stay, so it's not as if a maid had found the ring and put it on the table. The place didn't have a creepy feel at all. But we have absolutely no idea how my ring both vanished and then later reappeared while we were in the room. We actually had a trip to Japan booked for March 2020 and had reservations to stay at the same guest house again. So whenever we are able to rebook that trip, we'll stay there again, and maybe I'll bring a little offering in case there are some spirits in the place. The end. I just love the sweet, curious spirit or yokai or whatever it is that borrows a thing and then gives it back. I'm sure it will be delighted to meet Nemuri Mori and her husband again when they return and enjoy any little offering it gets presented with. Speaking of a mischievous creature, just as I was about to record this, a patron who lives in Japan wrote in on Discord and shared his story. And it reminded me of Nemuri's experience, so I asked if I could read it here. So this is what Dan wrote. The strangest thing happened to my wife and I just now, in our little hamlet on the outskirts of Tamba, Sasayama, Hyogo. My wife realizes she's lost her phone. The usual minor panic ensued. We called the restaurant, police station, etc. to no avail. Google's Find My Phone showed that it was turned on, that we could ring it at the highest volume, even if it was set to manner mode. However, the phone location could only be ascertained to a wide area. There was an unknown walking journey of about 4 minutes covering 700 meters leading down an unlit road around the rice fields about an hour before. Then the phone's location suddenly updated to an accuracy of 100 meters. So we got the torches out and we set off to the area while ringing it. Once we got to the spot, we heard a distant ringtone coming from the pitch-black mountain forest. There are no footpaths leading way up in the mountain. So we entered about 50 meters, and as the ringtone got louder, we could see the light coming from the screen. And there it was, half buried in a small hole. Our working theory is that a monkey picked it up outside our house and ran off with it before ditching it, perhaps after getting spooked by a notification or something. That's Dan's story, and he shared a screenshot of the Find My Phone app, and it really is in the middle of nowhere. Then there was a photo of the phone at night, half buried under grass and leaves, with the screen glowing. It's so creepy horror movie fodder. I guess it could be a monkey. Or it could be something else. Okay, for the last sent-in uncanny tale, I'll read one that didn't actually happen in Japan, but it's heartwarming, and once you hear it, you'll agree that it very well could have happened here. It's just a reminder that these things can happen anywhere. This is one from a listener named Chris, and he calls it the cold caring. Years ago, when my now adult daughter was 18 months to 3 years old, we lived in a large ramshackle Victorian house, which had seen better years and maintenance. The house was pretty cold in the winter, being heated by a monstrously large and inefficient gravity furnace in the basement. At the end of the hall and across from our room was my daughter's room, with large sun-filled windows. Every day we would scoop her out of her crib to start her day, and I would spend some time with her till I left for work. During the winters, we went to scoop her up and found that on every cold day, she was under the covers, pretty much tucked in, warm and snug. Eventually, my wife and I realized that neither one of us were checking in on her and tucking her up as we thought, so we asked her about it. She looked at us matter-of-factly and stated, "The grandma covers me up." "An old woman?" we asked. "She lives here. She sits in the rocky chair at night," she explained. "Monster," I called her Monster, "only you, the cats, and Mommy and Daddy live here." She shrugged and said we were wrong and described her to us. Afterwards, we did a bit of research and found that a prior owner in her later years had died in the house of natural causes. We started leaving tea and treats for her, and our daughter was cared for until we moved out several years later. The house was eventually demolished for new construction. We hope grandmother moved along to another family who would welcome her care. The end. See, that's sweet too. Okay, all that ended nicely. And I want to thank everyone who sent in their experiences to share. The last show, this one, and also for the next one, which will be all listener tales, nothing from me next time. Thank you very much. I also want to thank patrons and supporters again. Remember when I was so very enthusiastic at the end of last year and said I hoped we could get 300 patrons by January? But I can't do math, and I thought, gee, we only have 5 more patrons before we hit 300. But after I said that, I looked, and it seems I really can't do complicated math, like subtraction, and I discovered it was more like 30 patrons we needed, not 5. Well, I'm here today to tell you that I learned how to subtract, and for real, we only need 5 more patrons to hit the big 300. I double-checked, and I used a calculator even. So anyway, I'm going to let you all go for now. Thank you so much for listening and supporting the show. I will talk to you again very soon. Bye-bye. You've reached the end of the show, and I just want you to know how much we appreciate you listening and supporting us. Any subscribing, reviewing, and gushing to your friends, family, even random strangers, really does help keep us going. If you have the means and you want to help a little more and get a little more, we are making extra content over on Patreon, all for only $5 a month. Or, if you like to read horror, you might be interested in my Bram Stoker-nominated short story collection, The Carp-Faced Boy and Other Tales. 本当にありがとうございます. Thank you again, and I'll talk to you real soon. Thank you.